my sister Gemma Simmons. Here on FM, our Book of the Week, Last Man Off by Matt Lewis. The Suda Havid has been taking on more water than she can drain for some time. On the factory deck, though, Matt realises that a tipping point has been reached. The water is now pooling on the starboard side and the boat is leaning dangerously.
Saturday the 6th of June. The weight of the water pulled the Suda Havid down so that we hung there, like a boxer on the ropes, being pummeled by the giant waves. Bubbles and Boerti battled to keep the bow into the swells, but it was impossible. Any deviation from a head-on course was punished, exposing the vulnerable starboard hatches to the full force of the sea. If the boat was caught side-on to the swells, we would surely capsize. A wave hit the boat. With a sound like a gunshot, the storm door burst inward. Mornay and Big Dani waded in to push the door closed. Mornay turned the dogs, the levers that locked the door, but they would not catch. The gunshot had been the failure of two of the thick metal levers. Another wave. Mornay and Dani were powerless to keep the door closed against the flow. There was now no barrier to the ingress of water. I stood up from the pump I'd been working on, turning to see a flurry of bright orange shapes dancing across the factory. Unable to get into the locked cupboard where the life jackets were stored, Sven and Hannes had smashed the padlock off with an axe. Armfuls of life jackets were thrown down the stairs and along a chain of hands. It was time to leave the factory. Nothing more could be done there. After the chaos of the flooded factory, the dry corridor of the crew area was eerily serene. "What's happening?" I asked Trevor, almost flippantly. "Are we abandoning ship or what?" "Yes, Matt," he replied. "Matter of fact." Hearing it so bluntly, I was taken aback. Abandoned ship should be announced by a signal on the ship's whistles or a call over loudspeakers. Penge, one of the deckhands, appeared at the door next to Mornay and I. He was carrying a large sports holdall across his chest.
"Where the hell do you think you're going?" asked Hannes.
"I'm going home."
15:55, Saturday the 6th of June. I was still clinging to the hope that the Suda Havid would somehow survive, or that another boat would come to our aid. But until such a guardian angel materialised, we had to prepare to board the rafts. Of the four rafts deployed, only three had inflated. With 38 crew on board, I calculated that we would still be okay. Two of the rafts seated 12 men each. The largest could carry 20. That made 44 safe places. The three rafts were now all tethered near the stern, their bobbing orange canopies luminous against the dark clouds and grey sea. In just over an hour, the light would start to fade. Within 2 hours, it would be pitch black. If rescue was coming, it needed to be quick. 16:00 hours, Saturday the 6th of June. A roaming albatross above, the soul of a dead sailor, would have seen the ship now prone in the water. Her engines were still running, and smoke billowed from her exhausts, but her bow and starboard side were fully submerged, the rail slicing into the sea. I knew that I should be boarding a raft now, but I was concerned that people might still be below deck. I heard a noise to my left. It was Bjorgvin, staggering out onto deck. Bubbles had woken him just minutes before. No one else had thought to rouse him. I handed him a life jacket and tried to be brief. "We've taken water into the factory deck. We're going down. Everybody's abandoning ship." I climbed back up onto the portside guardrail of the ship, stepping along the edge of the rope crates as I picked my way toward the stern. At times I was walking on the side of the hull, impossible but for the extreme tilt. I stood on the stern gantry and turned for one last look. So this was what a doomed ship looked like. Bjorgvin was down by the starboard guardrail, bent over and struggling with something. "Bjorgvin, come on, man, come on," I yelled. "We've got to get off the boat." No, no, no. I'm trying to save Bubbles. Hidden from my view, Bubbles had collapsed on the deck, awash in freezing seawater. He was now leant on the starboard rail, being pummeled by the waves. Bjorgvin scrambled down to push him up, but Bubbles was too weak to climb. Using a rope, Bjorgvin heaved Bubbles out of the water and into the dry alleyway. Bjorgvin pulled his suit up and zipped it shut. He then handed Bubbles his own life jacket. Wearing only a jumper and jogging pants, Bubbles would not stand a chance in the sea without it. Balanced on the ledge at the very stern of his boat, he lay passively as we waited for the raft to come close enough. Bubbles was twice my weight, so there was no way I could lift him into the raft, but the swell lifted the raft back up towards us. Morne and Hunnis knelt, ready at the entrance to the raft with their arms outstretched. The raft was as close as it would be. I released my grip and let Bubbles tumble the last few feet into the embrace of his crew. I looked along the deck one last time just to check, then I waited for the raft to rise up on the next swell until it was just a few meters below. Letting go of the guardrail, I leapt, like a kid in a ball pool, into the raft below me. My body was flooded with adrenaline. At least we were off the sinking ship. I was the last man off. 1604, Saturday the 6th of June. The weak light of winter illuminated the life raft through its canopy, but it was so crowded and chaotic that it was difficult to see the faces crowded inside. Morne had found a safety cutter attached to the inside of the raft. He passed the serrated blade to Big Dani, who cut the painter which tethered the raft to the Sudahavid. We pushed to get free, but the wind blew us against the hull. A quick search found nothing that resembled paddles, so we tried to propel the 20-man raft against the wind with our hands. This had no effect, but after one more bounce against the boat, we seemed to move away. Just when we thought we were clear, the boat shifted, and the stern gantry came slamming down. This arch of heavy steel had once supported the trawl cables, but now the girders were slicing down onto the raft's roof, folding the raft in two and forcing us underwater. The raft flooded instantly. Frigid grey seawater plunged in, swirling around us, and then the boat shifted in the water and we were free. We were up to our waists in freezing seawater, but thank God we were leaving the boat behind. The Sudahavid was our one reference point in the storm. There was no land to gauge our movements. The sea and sky gave no clue as to our whereabouts. We had no idea in which direction safety lay. Without paddles, we could not dictate our movement either. For a few minutes, we drifted within sight of the Sudahavid as her list grew worse and her bow sank from view. It wasn't silence that was left when the engine finally stopped, but it felt like it. The wind continued howling and the waves were still crashing, but the thrum of the engine and the burbling of the exhaust, which had been our near constant percussion for the last 2 months, had stopped. I didn't see her sink. I missed her final moments. I don't think I could have borne seeing our life support system disappear from in front of us. Morne watched her go. The bow sank down first, the wheelhouse still visible. She then seemed to come back to level again, one final fight, but then the bow lifted from the water and she descended silently stern first. There was nothing around us now but the other two rafts, the waves and the wind. Barely any debris even.
Matt, is there a boat coming to save us?
Voices in the raft sought answers from someone who might know. Bubbles lay quiet, Borty was incoherent, and Bjorgvin was still being sick after swallowing too much seawater.
I don't know, I said.
I couldn't bring myself to give a full answer. Although I had heard a voice on the radio as we escaped, I wasn't even sure if they had received our position. I wondered how we could expect to be found in the darkness, and whether the raft could survive in its damaged state. A nighttime rescue seemed unlikely. Could we make it through until morning? There was now a gentle orange glow in the raft, emanating from the lights on the shoulders of the life jackets. They lit up when in contact with the seawater, but had only become noticeable as darkness had fallen. On the other side of the raft, Morny felt a pain in his foot. Fumbling underwater with his numbed fingers, he touched something clamping around his toes. In the twilight, he couldn't see what was causing him such pain.
Danny, there's something on my foot.
Big Danny reached down to help him and struggled to lift Morne's leg from the water. Up with it came a body, its mouth clamped onto Morne's toes. Danny shrank back. It was one of his fellow potmakers. He was dead. When they managed to release him, he disappeared back under the surface. Time passed, though I had no way to tell how much. How long had we been adrift? Morny and I were trying to fasten down the door of the raft, but the wind kept blowing it open. Each time the raft was invaded by a blast of wind and salt water, the precious warmth was stripped away. We were intent on fixing the door, but our fingers were so stiff now that it was almost impossible. Bubbles lay in the water in the center of the raft. His head was supported by the collar of his life jacket and his hands were tucked into his barrel chest. He had survived all this in only a jumper and tracksuit pants. I thought of Corinne at home in Scotland. We had not been together long enough. I wondered if I would ever have sex again. It seemed an absurd thought, such a long way from anywhere and anyone. There was little human noise in the raft now. In the darkness, Big Danny pulled Morne close, trying to keep warm. 3 hours or so had passed in the raft. Suddenly, Bubbles' voice rang out. He had looked near to death just minutes before, but now he began roll-calling all the crew he could remember. There were 17 of us in the raft when we boarded.
Bjorgvin, are you here?
Yes, Bubbles. I am here, still.
Warty.
Yes, Bubbles.
Kenny.
No reply.
Brian.
Yes, Skipper.
The roll calls went on. 3 or 4 times Bubbles called out our names, and it helped. The effort to force words from our mouths and to acknowledge Bubbles shook us from an idle descent into unconsciousness. Sometimes people no longer answered.
Boerti had been behaving oddly at times.
1 minute discussing with me whether to swim to the other raft, or wailing hopelessly the next. The stern gantry had hit him hard, and we were all so cold that these outbursts could be forgiven. Bubbles reached the end of his most recent roll call, and finished by calling out the name of his best friend.
Boerti.
No reply.
Boerti. Boerti.
He is dead, man, said Hannes. Stop.
Last Man Off was written by Matt Lewis, abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Sam Troughton. The producer was Karen Roos, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Most of the nation's greatest works of art may be housed in our national museums and galleries, but there are also thousands of important works in ordinary people's homes. The BBC's arts editor, Will Gompertz, has been tracking down some of it with the help of a letter.
I should introduce myself. I'm cynical and not taken to flights of fancy. Nor do I indulge my children. So writes Chris Cruikshank, who tells me that his son has put together a remarkable collection of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist paintings. Has he, I said, and I was off, on a train, to Lincolnshire as part of my quest to uncover the unknown art of the nation.
And that Art of the Nation begins on Radio 4 on Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock.